And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade, unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF, 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing to look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Last show, we were in the chapter, What's Yours is Mine. And we were looking at the problems that Uber causes in the markets that it serves. In September 2014, the National Federation of the Blind sued Uber, claiming that, quote, Uber is violating basic equal access requirements under both the ADA, which is the American with Disabilities Act, and state law. And there was also ADA-related cases being pursued in California, Texas, and Arizona. Individual events include drivers refusing to pick up blind customers accompanied by dogs and driving away from riders with wheelchairs without trying to find an alternative. The ADA requires vehicles for hire to offer reasonable accommodations for wheelchair users. But as urban planning professor Sandra Rosenblum said when interviewed by Ted Troutman of a nonprofit publication, Next City, quote, generally that phrase has meant nothing, unquote. Troutman also interviewed Lyft spokesperson to acknowledge that it's a challenge for Lyft and UberX to supply wheelchair accessible vehicles, because these are people's own cars that they use in everyday life to drive around. One effect of the transportation network's company's rapid rise is that in some cities, it could remove transit options for wheelchair users. If Lyft and Uber claim to provide urban transit, then universal access is a challenge that they must address. But there's little indication that they are doing so. In some cities, Uber has introduced programs, for example, called Uber Access and Uber Assist, to enable customers to call an accessible vehicle. But there's little evidence that these programs are effective, and the company has not made any data available about them. And Uber is pursuing a second track, which is to argue that the ADA does not apply to them. In one of the many cases of sharing economy companies wanting to eat their cake and have it too, Uber gives a big shrug of its shoulders. The law does not apply to them because they are not a public service. They're merely a technology company that matches drivers with riders, and they have no legal or contractual duty to control compliance with the law. Elsewhere, in Washington, D.C., Councilmember Mary Kay proposed legislation that would require taxicab companies to have 12% of their fleet accessible by the end of 2016 and report the number of people who request disability accessible vehicles. Uber has opposed this legislation too, saying that it could place excessive regulatory burdens on private vehicle for hire companies. Airbnb also asserts that requirements for non-discrimination and disabled access do not apply to most properties advertised on its site. Disability advocates have argued that the Airbnb website fails to help disabled people find appropriate accommodations. There's no way to search for listings that provide disabled access, and few listings say whether they are accessible or not. Airbnb, Uber, and Lyft each take steps to nudge or encourage their service providers to provide disabled access using language that emphasizes their commitment to helping disabled people. But that commitment apparently stops short of taking responsibility for the services that provide them with their revenue. In many cases, sharing economy companies have been arguing that municipal regulations are obsolete in the face of their new technologies and new business models. Disabled access rules are clearly not obsolete, so instead of companies arguing that it's not their problem, it is difficult to take companies seriously when they so clearly align their stated principles with their financial interests. The situation regarding ride-sharing and race is complex. In many American cities, particularly in New York, people of color have long maintained that they are routinely ignored by taxi drivers, and despite the rules surrounding universal access, cab companies do not service their neighborhoods. For example, in 2012, LaToya Peterson wrote at the Racialist blog about her repeated experiences of taxis, quote, not even bothering to pull to the side for a lone black girl on the corner, but happily picking up a white couple a few feet away. And contrasted that to Uber's premium service, quote, the price made me gag, but the rest of the experience was flawless. I knew exactly when my car would arrive. I received a text when they reached my location. I gave them a location without quibbling, and they rode there in peace. But as Peterson notes in a more recent post, it's worth unpacking what it is about Uber that led her to her experience. Taxi drivers may not get much control over their jobs. The one thing they do get control of is who they pick up and who they leave at the side of the road. So any discriminatory tendencies, implicit or explicit, among the taxi driver population has an easy way to make itself known. They will tend to leave people of color standing at the curb. There are two reasons why Uber drivers tend not to do the same. First, that summons that they get on their app does not show a picture of the customer, just a name, and so drivers must accept or reject fares without all the cues that taxi drivers have. Second, Uber requires drivers to accept 90% of all rides that are sent their way on pain of being removed from the service. So rejecting a potential ride comes at a stiff cost. Racism manifests itself differently in different environments, and the better experience of black customers is an unintended side effect of Uber's system. Uber drivers are not told where to drive so that they may avoid what they consider a sketchy part of town. And both Uber and Lyft have been accused of redlining, meaning not providing services to poor or minority neighborhoods. Numerous comments on social media suggest that one of the appeals of Uber and Lyft to young and well-off early adopters was that the drivers matched their age, educational level, and social background more than a man who has 60 hours on the clock that week. You could be picked up by a friend with a car, more likely to be a female, more likely to be well-educated, more likely to be white. As the companies have expanded, however, The driver population more closely matches taxi drivers, and this opportunity to discriminate has gradually faded. Discriminatory behavior does affect minority hosts on Airbnb. The listings include pictures of hosts and guests, so allowing any discriminatory tendencies among the user base can be expressed. Researchers Benjamin Edelman and Michelle Luca examined a set of listings and concluded that non-black hosts charge approximately 12% more than black hosts for equivalent rental. These effects are robust when controlling for all information visible in the Airbnb marketplace. Meanwhile, hotels in the USA are required to follow the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which guarantees full and equal access to any place of public accommodation. Discriminatory tendencies will show themselves if there is an opportunity to do so. The taxi, Uber, and Airbnb systems each let those tendencies express themselves in different ways. A similar effect happens when comparing methods of traffic policing. Individual traffic police officers can and do have a pattern of disproportionately stopping black drivers, while traffic cameras with automatic license plate recording act irrespective of the race of the driver. So in this way, a change of technology can cut down on specific incidents of racist behavior. Yet we should be careful about drawing general conclusions about the overall effect of any technology. As criminologist Clive Norris has shown, license plate recognition is now a way of tracking known individuals as they move around, and is no surprise who is tracked more and who is tracked less. The underlying problem remains. There's still racism in the system, but it is now manifested in different ways. Data acquisition shifts the place where racism happens from the street to the database quarry. There is no evidence of intentional discrimination by the companies themselves, and the patterns may change as the systems evolve. But we should be cautious about ascribing too much blame or credit to the companies involved. Money is one of the main points of contention for many jobs, but Uber is not just another employer. In fact, it's not an employer at all. Uber drivers are, quote unquote, partners, self-employed entrepreneurs who choose to work on the platform. The model of micro-entrepreneurs who can choose when to work independently is what makes Uber part of the booming sharing economy, along with others such as Airbnb. What seems at first like a lightweight and flexible model of work turns out in Uber's hands to be another way for the company to have it both ways. Uber makes it easy for new drivers to sign up. It publicizes that many drivers describe as unrealistic earnings that attract interest. It subsidizes its expansion into new cities, and its vehicle approval process is cursory. As journalist Natasha Tiku uncovered, the company's partnership with Santander Bank encouraged drivers to take out what amounts to subprime loans in order to buy a car. And when that partnership expired, Uber took to directly leasing cars to drivers. It sometimes seems as if Uber is reintroducing each of the problems of the taxi industry. A long-standing criticism has been that some taxi drivers have to pay to use the cab, and so start each shift in the red. Now Uber drivers put in long hours to pay off a purchase, and being kicked off the platform because of even more of a threat. Uber has taken advantage of its drivers' vulnerability by imposing more and more strenuous rules. Drivers must accept 90% of the ride requests, or they get a notification to improve your acceptance rate if you want to continue to use the Uber platform. Drivers claim that they have been deactivated for being critical of the company on Twitter. Drivers on the premium Uber Black service have been forced to take requests for the lower pay Uber X service. The company tracks driver locations and complains if they are not to the company's liking. But at the heart of the control is the rating system that permits riders to rate drivers. Chapter 6 explores rating systems in more detail, but a few words about Uber belongs here. Most riders give their drivers 5 stars out of 5 as the courtesy, 5 for 5. But if a driver's rating slips even slightly below 4.7 in many cities, they can be deactivated or kicked off the platform. The system makes drivers vulnerable to the most demanding of riders, as a small number of complaints can lead to the driver losing their livelihood. And of course, there is certainly no appeal, as the driver isn't an employee and the contract is not a work contract. The reports of happy and friendly Uber drivers take on a completely different meaning once you know the precariousness of the driver's situation. As Forbes' Jeff Berkovici reported, quote, Uber likes this system because it enjoys being able to say all of its drivers have near perfect ratings, but it's harsh for all the drivers and also for customers who find themselves repeatedly forced to choose between guilt, spite, and ignorance. While Uber dictates the behavior of drivers in more and more specific ways, it still takes none of the responsibility when things go wrong. Section 230 of the, quote, Communications Decency Act, unquote, may seem like an odd law to protect the company, but here's how it works. The law was initially introduced to say that blogs and other user content sites such as YouTube were not responsible for content posted by users. Fair enough. But now Uber says that it's not a taxi company. It just runs a website and an app and puts drivers in touch with riders. Anything that goes wrong is not Uber's responsibility, it's the driver's. The law is an American one, but challenging Uber is going to be expensive in other countries too, and maybe prohibitively so, given the company's formidable bank account. Uber's rules seem to step over the line regarding whether a driver is or is not an employee, according to the Canada Revenue Agency rules. Sharing economy workers are facing this issue with other companies too. See Chapter 7. It's an issue that other industries face, such as construction. And the root cause is always the same. Classification as an independent contractor relieves the hiring company, Uber in this case, from having to pay employment insurance premiums, sick leave, and from holiday pay, and from having to abide by other employment standards. The risk is pushed entirely onto the subcontractor.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Well, welcome back. We're looking at the book What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. We're still working on the chapter, What's Yours is Mine. If cities decide to put taxi regulations to the one side for ride-sharing companies, many important decisions are handed over to the company. As shown in Chapter 7, technology industries are often winner-take-all markets, where the winner has significant market power. So it matters what kind of company Uber really is. It's a company that has experienced a lot of controversy. Among the most high-profile events was a dinner in which Uber executive Emil Michael told journalist Ben Smith that he had considered investigating the private life of Sarah Lacey, a journalist who had criticized Uber. Unlike a driver with a bad rating, Michael was forgiven by the company. Uber is a company that spies on its customers using what it called God views of company data, which is shown at company events for entertainment and posted about on its website. It's a company whose New York general manager, Josh Moher, is being investigated internally for tracking a female journalist without her consent. It's a company whose employees have warned another female journalist that, quote, company higher-ups might access the journalist's rider's logs, unquote. I emphasize female journalists here because the culture of the company is a big part of the problem. Do we want to hand over city streets to a company whose CEO wisecracks about women on demand? Yeah, we call that boober, which can and does track one-night stands and posts a blog entry about data called Rides of Glory, now removed, which more damagingly ran a campaign in France, now also removed, called Avion de Chasse, to pair Uber drivers with hot chick drivers. As the company posted on the English version of its website, Avion de Chasse is a French term for fighter jets, but also the colloquial term to designate incredibly hot chick. Lucky you, the world's most beautiful avion are waiting for you on this app. Sit back, relax, and let them take you to a cloud. The promotional material focused unsurprisingly on the driver's breasts. This is a company that responded to a complaint by a female customer that she was driven 20 miles out of her way to be abandoned by saying it was an inefficient route. It's also a company that coaches Miami drivers how to circumvent laws. It's a company that ordered and canceled over 5,000 rides with its main competitor to interfere with their service. It's a company that sets out to dupe newspapers with fake PR and which now talks of weaponizing the facts. In its PR campaigns, the company really likes its military analogies. In short, it's a company that reflects the worst of the macho culture of some parts of the technology industry. Uber's commitment to places where it runs is minimal. It is remarkable that among all the privacy problems, Canadian cities are generally allowing Uber to operate freely. Although the company has a privacy policy for the U.S., it has no Canadian privacy policy. That's how much Uber is thinking for all of its massive funding base about privacy issues and the different requirements of operating in different cities. From a tax point of view, Uber is parasitic on local economies. When you pay a taxi driver, part of the money goes to the taxi company he or she drives for, and that taxi company pays taxes in your city, and so the money feeds back into the local economy. However, when you pay the Uber driver, the situation is different. After a Toronto councillor obtained an email stating that there was no tax charge on Uber rides, the company claimed that its drivers are expected to collect sales tax, even though the cashless transaction is part of the service's appeal. Whatever happens to the driver's portion of the fare, the company's cut is tax-free. Like many digital companies, Uber has set up subsidiaries around the world. If you take an Uber in Canada, your credit card payment will go to Uber BV, incorporated in the Netherlands for tax reasons. By the time this book goes to press, this chapter will be outdated in that new events will have superseded old ones. But that won't change. And that's the question of how to build an accessible, affordable, and sustainable transit system for cities around the world. And what won't change is that, for Uber to be a constructive part of such a system, it cannot be allowed to sit in its own rules and its own agenda and its own wastes in the way that it's done over the last 2 years. We're going to start a little bit of Chapter 5 before the end of the show here. Chapter 5 is Neighbors Helping Neighbors. Personal and home services like house cleaning, handyman tasks, and deliveries is a disparate, crowded, and rapidly changing field with many competing companies and as yet no clear winner. In this way, it is different from the world of Airbnb and Uber. The evolution of the sector tells us what happens when competition forces an evolution of business models. TaskRabbit. The first company in this space was TaskRabbit, which started out at the same time as Airbnb, Lyft, and others. The listing for TaskRabbit on the business information website Crunchbase describes the moment when the company founder had her idea. It was a cold night in Boston, February 2008, when Leah Busk realized she was out of dog food for her 100-pound yellow lab, Kobe. Leah thought to herself, wouldn't it be nice if there was a place online where I could go to connect with my neighbors, perhaps one who was already at the store at the moment and we could help me out. From this experience, TaskRabbit, formerly Run My Errand, was online and mobile marketplace that connects neighbors to get things done. And what they did was now born Neighbors Helping Neighbors. It's an old school concept reimagined for today. TaskRabbit was set up as an eBay for errands and offers a range of services. The two that gain the most attention can be done by any young, healthy person, standing in line for concert tickets or for new iPhones and assembling a IKEA furniture, well, almost everyone. And the going rate for a task was settled by an auction, with TaskRabbit bidding for the job. This practice reflected the way homeowners might negotiate with someone who offers to clear their driveway of snow, or the way babysitting rates have settled informally, or the way that eBay used auctions in its early years. Leah Busk used the familiar language of empowerment. Providing people with the tools and resources to set their own schedules, be their own bosses, and say how much they want to get paid for incredibly empowering work. It has huge implications for the global workforce, unquote. So we're going to continue looking at this and these shows, companies such as TaskRabbit and similar companies in future shows. So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.